Nadav Pinchas.
He is so cute.
Adorable. Okay, so we're going to look at the Mishnah here on Daf Lamed Hey Amud Aleph. And just by way of introduction, we have a principle called Hamotzi Mekavero Olav Araya. And this Mishnah in Bava Kama Lamed Hey is perhaps one of, I would say, the two major sources for this halacha. The other one is Bav Metzia Daf Kuf. And what it means is, we say that possession is 9/10 of the law. The burden of proof is always on someone who wants to remove and force someone else to pay. So we always have two litigants. We have the Toveya called the plaintiff, and we have the Nitba called the defendant. And it's the burden of the plaintiff to come up with evidence to establish his claim. Otherwise, basically, the Shevi Alta said, you know, they're in a passive situation. They're not going to remove someone's possession over Mammon simply because of a tvia. You know, if I come over to you and say, well, you know, the shirt you're wearing is mine, and you deny it, you know, we're not going to establish that there's a suffix here, you know, that we have to take out someone's mammon from his possession simply because of a claim. And perhaps the source in the Torah for our Mishnah is a parasha in Shmos. If you want to make a note of it, it's in Perek of Dalet, Posuk Yudalet, and there it says, V'el haskenim omar shvu lanu bozeh ad asher noshuv aleichem. And basically, the zkenim, those are the judges, say that, you know, let's see ad asher noshuv aleichem. Hine Aaron v'chur imochem mi bal dvorim yigash aleichem. What does mi bal dvarim yigash aleihem means? Yigash raya aleihem. Let him bring his proof to this Canaan. And if he doesn't have evidence, again, there's a whole question, what constitutes evidence? You need two witnesses. Is one witness enough? What about circumstantial evidence, which is called in Lashon HaShas Umdana? What about the possibility of bringing evidence from someone who normally would not be reliable? What about chazakah? Is chazakah considered evidence? The fact that I possess it. And perhaps there are two dimensions to chazakah. One chazakah is that Beis Din will not take money out of its possession. They're not going to actively change the status quo. And another halacha is the very fact that I possess it. That itself is a proof, a birur, or a raya that it's mine. Otherwise, what's it doing in my possession? So let's learn the Mishnah now. Shor shayorodef achar shor acher. What we have here on the bottom of Lamed Hey Amud Aleph is the case of, we'll call it Reuven Shor and Shimon Shor. So we know that the Shor of Reuven is running after the Shor of Shimon. I mean, that already gives indication that there's some belligerent intention here on the part of the Shor of Reuven. The Huzak. And now, lo and behold, we see the results. And the Shor of Shimon is got, you know, he's full of holes in his body, so to speak. Now, how did he get these holes? Well, it seems obvious that it's the Shor of Reuven, the Rodev, that gored Shimon, the Shor of Shimon, I mean, and that's why the Shor of Shimon is hurting so badly. But in fact, there's going to be claims and counterclaims. Now, you might want to write down on a piece of paper, just so you don't get confused about this, that in all the cases we're going to learn in this Mishnah, and there are many of them, the Nizak is the Toveya. The Mazik is the Nitva. You know, it's a little bit confusing. So whenever you see the Nizak, the one who suffered damages, he's the Toveya, he's the plaintiff, he's suing for damages. And whenever you see the Mazik, he's actually the defendant. He's the nitba. It's a little bit strange because usually we think of the mazik as the one who was active, but really, in terms of the dispute in front of the courts, the mazik is really on the defensive. The nizak is on the offensive. You know, he wants to get back what was lost. So we have the following: Zeh Omer. Right, that's without the vav of vizeh. Zeh Omer, meaning the Toveah, because the the plaintiff is always mentioned first in the Mishnah, because he's the one who starts off, you know, this whole process of a decision in Beis Din. So the Nizak is, as we said before, the Tovea. He says, Shor Chahizik, your Shor damaged my Shor. Okay, so the owner of the Nirdaf is talking to the owner of the Rodef. What's the counterclaim? Ze Omer Loki Elabisela Lota. Now notice, it's not that the Shor, not that the Baal Shor Hamazik, we call him Reuven, it's not that he's denying that his Shor was a Rodef, but that's not enough to clinch the claim of the Nizak that the Mazik caused this damage. You know, we're not so excited about the Shor HaMazik because he's a Rodef. You know, that itself, you know, is already, you know, like sort of, you know, it lights up some red lights, you know, in our minds. But Rodef per se is not enough to engender a chiyuv nezikin. We need that there be what I call a maisa hezek. Redifa itself is not a maisa hezek. It may set up circumstantial evidence that indicates that there is an intention on the part of the shor to damage, but was there at the end of the day a damage? Like, for example, you could have a case where someone throws a kli, a utensil that belongs to some other person, off the top of a roof. He has full intention to damage. He might not be chayav because someone else came along and caught the kli in flight and smashed the kli. And the Gemara establishes, that's a sugya back in Perek Ketz at a regal, that the thrower is not chayav. Why? Because since he didn't destroy the kli by his act, that's not called a maisa hezek. All of Hilchas Nezikin revolves around the maisa hezek. So again, the shor harodef definitely has intention to do damage, but before, according to the claim of the Baal shor harodef, meaning according to Reuven's claim in the courts, before the shor had an opportunity to gore, the nirdaf smacked himself up against a sela, and the holes in its body did it under are not holes that came from the, what do you say?
From the
horns of the rodev, but rather from the very sharp, you know, pinnacles in this cell.
The fact that the shore ran into the rock because he was running away from
the rock. Oh, excellent, okay. Oh, you already said that? Okay, excellent. So, lahavdil in tort law, in civil law, the secular courts, is something called contributing damages, contributory damages. The halacha is a little bit shy or inhibited about contributory damages. I mean, there is one case that we know of contributory damages where Reuven Shor pushed Shimon Shor into Levi's bar, right? So if not for Levi's bar, it wouldn't have damaged itself at the bottom of the bar. If not for Reuven running after Shimon's Shor, then it wouldn't have fallen into the bar. So in that case, there are two mazikim, each contributing half the damage. So there is room within the universe of halacha to find a precedent for causing a damage. But what I want to do with you, in order to analyze this question, is to read Rashi very carefully. Because I told you one thing, and Rashi's going to tell you something totally different. And we're going to want to rack our brains to figure out why Rashi did this. I described the situation in a way that led you to my conclusion, what I wanted to conclude, namely that the Redifa itself was ultimately the cause of the damage. Again, when I mean to say ultimately, it was like a first cause. It wasn't the final cause. The final cause was that the Nirdaf smacked itself up in against the Sela. But Rashi says something totally different. Rashi says, and this is two lines up before the end of your page, Bisela Loka, Mischachech Haya Bisela Veloka. Now this word Mischachech is almost a code word. It's not, I can translate it literally for you, and that's what we're going to do, but that's not really the point, because this word Mischachech throughout Masechta Bava Kamma has a specific conceptual meaning to it. Because there's something called shame. In the first mission of Bava Kamma, there are four super categories of Nezikin, one of which is called shame. And shame literally means eating. But shame is a concept that has many different cases and different scenarios. The classical scenario, which is called the Tolda of shame, is Nischachecha Bekosa. I have no doubt in my mind that it's not coincidental that Rashi at least subconsciously had in mind that sugya of the told of shame. Now, shame, by its very definition, is called urche. What defines both the av of shame and its toldos is called urche. Urche means normal behavior. It's what we can predictable. The animal eats, because that's what an animal does. I remember I was once with my kids in zoo, and we were watching the camel. And the camel didn't stop eating. You know, I wonder how strong its jaw muscles are, which is just amazing. But that's what animals do, that's what humans do too. But maybe animals in a more profound way than humans, but you can rely on an animal to eat. That reliability is called urche. That's what shame is all about. And Gemara describes a case where the animal is itching its body. So what it does is the animal moves very close to the kosel and starts scratching itself on the blitos, you know, those protrusions in the wall. And then it knocks over the wall. That causes a great damage. You know, back in the day, you know, the way that you put up boundaries around your property, your private property, was through these sullen, these walls. And now you have to restructure the wall. The point of Nischachecha Bekosel, what I mean by the point, I don't mean the point on the wall in the stone, but I mean the point of conceptualization here of Nischachecha Bekosel is that what the Rodev, the owner of the Rodev, is claiming is that your animal damaged itself stupidly, but in a way that it had nothing to do with my animal whatsoever. Do you follow? It wasn't the way we understood it, and what I'm going to try to show to you, I'm going to try to prove to you when I say we, that there were other Rishonim other than Rashi that gave that offered an alternative possibility, that the animal ran into the cellar because of the Radifa. Mm-hmm. You know, imagine the animal is running backwards, so to speak, and boom, it hits itself up against the coast. So Rashi says, no, Nischachecha Bekosel. The animal was minding its own business, and the damage that it suffered had nothing to do whatsoever with my Shor HaRodef, so claims the Baal Shor HaRodef. And you know what? I didn't even contribute to the Hezek. Now, the one who noticed this Rashi and makes a big to-do about this Rashi is the Rashash. The Rashash lived, I would say, about a century ago, a little bit more than a century ago, and his commentary on the Shas is published in the back of the Talmud in Bavli. And the Rashash, I'll just summarize what he says here. He writes that Lefi Rashi, Tainas Ha Rodef, he Shalo Machmas Ridifoso Nitkal Hanirdaf Bisela Veloka. It was, again, there's a lot of words here, but basically saying that according to the owner of the Rodev, the Shar Rodev, it was not machmas, it was not a result of the Radifa that this Shar died. There were two events that happened within close proximity of time that had nothing to do. There's no correlation. I remember when we were kids and we were studying science, and they told us about scientific experiments. The worst thing about, you know, the worst failure of science, the worst mistake you can make in any experiment is by correlating two factors that have nothing to do with each other. But you think they're correlated because they happened at the same time. That's exactly what Rashi says is in the mouth and the claim of the defendant here, the owner of the road. If there are two events that happened that had no correlation, there was no cause and effect relationship, because the animal, in fact, did not smash itself into the cellar because of the redifa, but rather shalom achmas redifa. The animal was walking past the kosel, a very sharp kosel, which damaged itself. So this is fascinating, because the implication, says the Rosh Hashanah of Rashi, is lu yitzuyer. If the rodef would admit, he would confess in front of the court that the animal was damaged and smashed itself up against this cellar because of the redifa, you know, in its retreat, then the rodef would be chayav. That would be a confession of hodas baldin. Then the Rosh Hashanah goes in and he says, but let's look in the Rishonim. And one of the prime Rishonim, the commentaries on the Gemara of on the Sefer Bava Kamma, is the Nemuke Yosef, who's published around the Rif. The Nemuke Yosef writes that no, the claim of the Rodef was Shenifka Upgi Aso Shalashar Minasela. That it was the cella that was a result, that was the running into the cella, not the nischachach of the kosel, was the cause of its damage. Vehi nifka machmas haredifa. As a result of the redifa, the animal retreated, and the fugitive animal running away from the rodef went smash into the cella. The afalpi. Listen to the Nemuke Yosef. Shemachmas haredifa nizok. Even though this shor of Shimon was damaged as a result of the redifa of the shor of Reuven, nevertheless mikomakom patur Reuven. Nevertheless, Reuven's claim that he doesn't have to pay damages is still correct. And why? The eino ella grama v'grama v'nezikin patur. Now, let's say a few words about grum, because I honestly believe, and I'm hoping that some lawyers either here or elsewhere is going to come and tell me I'm wrong. I'm convinced that the invention of the concept of grum is a Jewish invention, and the goyim still don't know beans about what grum means. So I'll give you an example. If, let's say, you have money invested in a bank account, and I would steal that money somehow by going into your computer, you know, using your secret code and extracting money from your bank account, then I have no doubt that given the fact that the interest rate is 3%, if it took 6 months until you were able to retrieve the embezzled money, you would be able to claim and sue me not just for 100 but for 103, if you follow my point. In halacha, there's no such thing. That's called grama b'nezikin. Grama b'nezikin means indirect damage. I have to pay damages in halacha for that which I directly damage. That which is indirect, you know, the fact that you had an investment here, you know, based on the interest rate, and you could have taken that money and gained, you know, $3 for every $100 over the course of a year or whatever it might be. I have no liability for that kind of a thing. That's called grama. And as far as I know, again, and I'm waiting for a lawyer to tell me I'm wrong, you know, actually I'd be happy if somebody told me I was wrong, in secular law, liability means I've got to give you back the whole, you know, everything and nothing but. And if your money was invested, I got to give you back the guaranteed interest rate, and that has to be paid as well. And I'm sure there are better examples than the one I gave. Be that as it may, comes along the Nemuke Yosef, and the Rosh Hashanah is the one who found this Nemuke Yosef and really brought it to our attention. And he says, wait a minute, if the Rodef admits in the court that the hezek was a result of the redifa, because the arrow of the nirdaf retreated and smashed itself on the... That's a valid claim. He's potter. He doesn't have to pay damage for that. There was no need, says the Mugios, for Rashi to introduce a new element here and tell us that the nirdaf was nischachach abakosa, because Grumman is zikin pot. And this concept of Grumman and Ezekiel is so fundamental to halacha and has so many implications and repercussions. You know, the Gemara says, for example, in Perek HaKonis, which I'm still hoping we're going to learn, but we need more time to prepare it, is that if I hire false witnesses to testify that you owe me $1,000, even though I caused that damage, I don't have to pay for it. Because causative damage is not, does not generate in general liability in halach. There is such a thing as a moral law, a greater moral law, which is called a chiyuv bidei shamayim. That's a whole different discussion. But as far as Bezdin is concerned, grav in Ezekin pot. And if the Rashash is correct here, now we have to rack our brains to try to figure out what does Rashi do with this principle of Grum ben Ezekiel. Because if Rashi is implying that the Shar, once the Shar Nirdaf, once it smacks into the Sela, Machmas Haradifa, and there the owner of the Rodef would have to pay damages, if that's what Rashi is implying, when the Rashash understood it, why isn't that a violation of the principle of Grum ben Ezekiel? And I'd like to suggest the following, that there's such a thing called an animal pushing another animal. Like, let's say, for example, in a car accident, if Reuven's car smashes into Shimon's, and Shimon's car keeps rolling because of the impact, until it goes down a ravine, or until it smacks up against a pole, or whatever have you, that would not be considered, at least according to Rashi, grum. Why? Because the Gemara tells us that if an animal gores another animal, and the animal gets sicker and sicker and sicker, so to speak, in other words, the injury multiplies with the passage of time, then the Baal Hashar Mazik will pay for the depreciation of the Nizak as it's evaluated at the time of Hamad Bidin, not at the time of the Negicha, of the Maisa Hezek. Why? Says the Gemara, because the Keren, meaning the horn of the Mazik, is embedded, this is a figuratively speaking, not, but the Gemara uses it, is embedded in the neck of the Nizak. And the damage process is continuous. And what you see from this is that the Maisa Hezek, which began at time T1, at the time of the Negicha, continues up until the T2, which is called Hamad Bidin. And here also, the Maisa Hezek can be extended, says Rashi, until we finally see that this process of Redifa reached its fruition, its culmination. When does the Redifa end? When finally the Redifa ends. But if the Redifa continues until the point that the Shara Rodif is very satisfied because the Nirdof Nebuch is down on all fours because it smashed into the song, that is all considered one Maisahed, and it's not called Grum ben Ezekiel. And this really touches on a whole other sugya in Nezikin, which is called Garmi, but again, that's not for us now. If I burn your Shtaros, whether I have to pay for that, because now you can no longer collect your debts because you have no proof, and that's called an indirect damage, but on the other hand, it might incur liability under the law of Garmi. So again, let's go back to our Mishnah. You've got a claim and a counterclaim. The claim of the plaintiff of the Toveh, who's the Nizak, is that your shar gored my shar, and it was a direct damage, you have to pay for that. The counterclaim of the Mazik, of the Rodev, who's now the defendant, is, you know what? Your shar died, but not as a result of my redif. There was no goring that took place. So what does Bezdin do in this case? Says the Mishnah, Hamotzi mechavero olafarai. The burden of proof is on the shoulders of the plaintiff, the tovan, the nizak, until he can prove with two witnesses that indeed the shor, the rodef, gored his shor, he cannot collect damages. But that's case number one. Now we get to case number two. And now the story gets a little more exciting. Okay, there are two oxen that are chasing one ox. Now, we have here now three people. We've got Reuven, we've got Shimon, and we've got Levi. Okay? Let's now shift the name of the Nizak. The owner of the damaged shor is now Levi. Before it was Shimon, but now it's Levi. So you have a shor that's owned by Reuven, you have a shor that's owned by Shimon. Both of these shvarim are rodfim. And you have the shor of Levi. Now, in this particular case, we know that Levi's shor died of negicha. Not like we discussed before, did Levi's shor smash up against a sela? No. Levi's shor clearly has negicha marks in its body. But what we don't know is which shor identified, will the real Mazik please stand up over here? We're not clear, and even the Adam cannot clarify whether it was the shor of Reuven that attacked Levi's shor, or was it the shor of Shimon that attacked Levi's shor? And the Mishnah says, Shneyem Ptu.
Oh,
I skipped. I'm sorry.
These the two Rodfim.
Yeah. Sorry. Thanks, David. I got so excited.
Isaac doesn't say anything.
Right. Ze Omer Sharcha Hizik, Vize Omer Sharcha Hizik. Each one points to the other one. He's the one. And in this case, if there's no evidence that can establish beyond the shadow of a doubt which Shar was the Mazik, is both Reuven and Shimon walk out of there, Pturim, clean like a whistle. And the unfortunate person here in this case, who fell between the cracks, is Levi the Nizak. Now, in secular law, Lahavdil again, there's such a thing as submitting a claim against two people. And in a sense, you create a kind of cartel, a joint defendant, because both Reuven and Shimon owned animals that are rodfim. But in Halacha, it doesn't work that way. There's no such thing. You have to be tovel one specific person. Oh. But now, let's change the reality. Let's say that both of these oxen were owned by one person. So we go back to our Reuven and Shimon model. So Reuven owns two oxen. Is that the plural of ox? Oxen? Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't know. I guess it depends on what country you live in, but we'll call it oxen, right? And Shimon now is the owner of a dead ox. Now we know that Shimon's ox was killed by one of two oxen, both of which belong to Reuven. But we'll never be able to know which is the ox that actually gored Shimon's shor. So what do you say in this case? In this case, he's chai. Why? Im hayu shneim shal ish echad, says the Mishnah, if they are both owned by one person, shneim chayov means both oxen are chayv, which means the owner of these two oxen is chayv, because no matter how you slice the cake, he owes him damages. We don't have to know exactly why he owes him damages. We know for sure he owes him damages because mimanashav, no matter which ox gourd, they both are owned by the same person.
In the previous case, we had two owners. Let's say one of them really thinks it was his ox, but all he has to do is blame the other person and get off scot-free.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, in a certain sense, they could have staged this whole thing, from the get-go, if they were in collusion in such a way that the Adam would not know and identify which ox was it. But you know what? The halach has to work with the assumption that kavdeu v'chashdeu. You know, on the one hand, we have to assume everyone's telling the truth, and on the other hand, you know, we have to make sure that he is telling the truth. You know, even if the nizak were to say again, we're going back to the case of Reuven, Shimon, and Levi, your case, right? Even if Levi were to say that I know which of the two shvarim, if the defendant would deny it, then we're back to the original case of the Mishnah, which means Hamotzi Mechabel of a Raya. So in a sense, my heart goes out for Levi because it fell between the cracks. There's definitely someone who's guilty, but if you can't point your finger and prove I accuse him, j'accuse, you know, we don't know who's the guilty party, you can't collect damages because you're going to be bounced around from one to the other. The Gemara, for example, in Bava Metzia has a similar case. Let's say I borrowed money from one of two people, and it's either Reuven who lent me the money or Shimon who lent me the money. If neither Reuven nor Shimon could prove that I'm the one who lent you the money, then Levi, as it turns out, doesn't have to pay either of them. Now, again, the Gemara is going to set up a different case in a case of a Gazlan, where the Gazlan stole money. He doesn't know who from whom he stole the money. There he's going to have to pay back every single one. It's a wild case because anybody can come along. And there are modern cases that actually parallel this in contemporary society. Now the Mishnah goes on. And in order to appreciate the next part of the Mishnah, we have to discuss what's called a shor tam and a shor mu'ot. Now, a shor mu'ot pays nezek shalem, a shor tam pays chatzi nezek. But that's not the end of the story. The story goes on. When an owner of a shor mu'ot is found guilty and he has to pay compensation, that compensation is out of pocket, meaning the owner of the shor hamu'ot will have to write a check. Not so in the case of a shor tam. A shor tam pays chatzi nezek migufo, which means that all the collection of compensation on the part of the nizak has to come from the shor itself. The shor will be sold, and its monies will be divided up. The nizak will get half of its monies. Again, obviously there's another variable here. Now, what was the extent of the damage? But let's assume, here I'll give you the following scenario. Let's say the damage to the nizak was 500. He lost a pedigree ox that's, you know, stout. Now, the mazik in this case will have to pay how much?
$250.
But let's say the shor of the mazik was not such a pedigree, and it's worth $100. The maximum that the nizak could collect, to arrive at compensation of $250 is $100. He can't get one penny beyond that $100 because the ceiling collectability rights of the nizak is the value of the shor mazik, which in this case was valued at $100. Now, obviously, given that context, the nizak is going to have vested interest, so to speak, in proving, establishing that the nezek took place as a result of a shor mu'ot for two reasons. Number one, that he can collect the full value of the hezek, which, let's say, the value of the hezek was $500. But number two, he can be machayev the baal hamazik to pay out of pocket. The baal hamazik can't say, well, go collect for my shor, and my dinky old shor is only worth $100. And that's the maximum you can get. That's true in a shor tam. So that there's going to be a tremendous argument here between the owner of the mazik and the nizak as to what was the nature of the status of the shor mazik. Was it a mu'ot or was it a tam? Obviously, the nizak wants to claim it was a shor mu'ot. That gives him two advantages. If the mazik on the other hand wins out and he we accept his claim that it was a shor tam, then not only is he cutting by 50% the amount of money he'll pay, he may be cutting down significant additional money because that payment is limited to migufo And that is, I think, a good introduction to the next part of the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, Hoya echad gadol, the echad katan, hanizek omer gadol hizik, vamazik omer loki ella katan hizik. So the word gadol here, which literally translates to large shor, really should be reinterpreted. A large shor means a more valuable shor in this case. Which is true, usually the larger the size of the ox, the stronger it is as a work ox, or the more it's worth on the meat market. If you shecht it, there's plenty of meat there, whatever it is. So gadol means expensive. Katan means cheap, low value in terms of its market value. And now we're talking about a case of sharta. Now, if it's a sharta, you could only collect, as we said before, migufa. So obviously the nizak, in this case, has vested interest in claiming that the shor that damaged it was the shor gadol. If the shor gadol is there, then the nizak could collect damages all the way up to the value of the shor hamazik, in this case the shor gadol. And that's why the Mishnah says, hanizak omer gadol hizik. Now, does he really, really, honestly know that of these two shvarim it was the gadol that damaged him? I mean, the shor katan is also capable of goring. So I don't know if he's fibbing, if he's lying, or if he's being honest. He was there and he saw and he knows. I don't know anything. All I know is that this is the claim that he puts forth. Va'amazik omer, what is the counterclaim of the defendant, in this case the mitbah, the mazik? Loki ella katan hizik. Now the lokiela sounds like a very strong proposition or claim. No, it was the cotton that was mazik. And if it was the cotton that was mazik, I'm sorry, buddy, you're not going to get much in damages. You know, your shor may have been worth thousands, but the cotton was mazik. The maximum ceiling that you could collect is from the shor hakotan. Now, notice the Mishnah doesn't even tell you what the law is. And if you had to guess, what would you assume? Correct, Hamotzim Chavol Araya, meaning that the Mazik, as the defendant, is holding on to his money. You want to claim money, you have to prove it. So the Nizik is going to be in big trouble if he doesn't have any evidence to prove that the Shor Gadol was the Mazik. The Mishnah doesn't bother even mentioning the Psak. Why? Because the very next case is to be seen as an extension, and the Hamotzim Chavero is an umbrella kind of general principle that's going to apply to the next case that we're going to read now, and the case that we just finished studying. Now, the Mazik himself owns two shvar, echad tam v'echad muat. But now the question is, which of the two shvarim did the Hezek? You see, in the ratio of the Mishnah that we studied before, where you don't know which ox gored, there, since both oxen were owned by the same person, Mimonashok, you have rights to claim damages. But here, it's not a question of claiming damages as much as claiming how much damages. Do I claim damages up to the value of the Shor HaGadol, or am I limited to collect damages, as the Nizak, up to the value of the Shor HaKadol? So the Mishnah says, Echad tam v'echad muad, hanizek omer, of course the nizek is going to say muad hizik, v'amazik omer lokiela tam hizik. And again, even though both of the shmarim are owned by the same individual, and the muchzak, right, the one who is in a defensive position, he would rather pay damages of a short time, is Amotz Mekavel Rai. If the Nizak wants to claim, no, I get much more damages, I get full compensation, not half compensation, I get to collect from the value from the bank account of the Mazik, you know, he'll write me a check, is unfortunately Amotz Mekavel Rai. The Nizak has the lower hand, the Mazik has the upper hand, because the Mazik is Muchzak. And when the Mazik says, okay, I'll pay you damages, but I'll pay you damages under the law of Shartav, which I claim the damager was the Shartav, is the Mazik wins out. And here the Mishnah spells out a motzi mechavel araya, but it goes back on the previous case as well, where we don't know whether it was the gadol was mazik or it was the katan was mazik, and both shvarim were owned by one individual. In that case, a motzi mechavel araya. And here also, in the case where we don't know whether the muad was mazik or the tam was mazik, is a motzi mechavel araya. So again, we have two. We have sort of like two variables or two variations here. We have number one, we don't know which shor was mazik, and the relevance is because there's a shor that's worth a lot more money, but we're talking about a shor tam here. Or where we don't know, even if both shor are the same size and the same price on the market, but we don't know which shor was the tam. I mean, we know which one is the tam, we know which one is the muad, but we don't know whether the tam was mazik or the muad was mazik. And that too comes under the principle of Hamotzi Michavero Olav Harai. And finally, we get to what I call Roman numeral number 3, the third part of this Mishnah. Hayu Hanizakim Shnayim. There were two Shvarim now that were damaged. Echad Gadol v'Echad Katan. And who damaged these two Shvarim? V'amazikim Shnayim. Echad Gadol v'Echad Katan. This is what I call the matching question. How do you match these up? Hanizak Omer Gadol Hizik Es HaGadol. Well, that's great. Why? Because Hanizak gains two things. Number one, he's going to gain a... So now we're talking about a short time. So we have to assume he's talking about migufo mishalim. He's collecting from the shor mazik, and if the shor mazik was worth that much more, then he collects that much more. Not only that, he's got more vested interest to collect more because what was damaged by him was a very expensive animal. So chatzi nezik of a shor gadol is a humongous sum of money. And that significant amount of money could be collected from a shor gadol, according to the claim of the nizak, which is worth that much more money. Hakatan es hakatan. V'amazik, or what's the counter claim of the mazik, the defendant? No, loki ella, it wasn't the way you describe it. Katan es hagadol, meaning katan hizik es hagadol. Well, if cotton is a god, all that cotton is not worth much on the market, that severely limits the ability of the nizak to collect damages. He's confined to the value of the shor mazik, which is the cotton. And then there's another claim that's advantageous to the mazik, to the mazik, to round out the picture. Gadol, again, I'm going to add the word hizik, es hakatan. Well, if gadol hizik es hakatan, that means that there's going to be a very limited amount of liability of compensation, because the katan itself is only worth 100, and half of that is only 50. And why waste the gadol on the gadol? Why not use up the gadol on the katan? And again, the Mishnah doesn't even bother spelling out Hamotzi Mechavel Araya, because it wants to combine this with another scenario, again a matching scenario. Echad Tam, the Echad Muad. Now we're talking about a case where the Mazik had one Shar that was a Shar Tam, not like we had in the previous case, one Shar was a Gadol and the other was a Katan. And the Mazik had another Shar, which is the Shar Muad. Hanizak Omer Muad Hizik Es HaGadol V'Tam Es HaKatan V'Mazik Omer Loki Ela Tam Es HaGadol U'Muad Es HaKatan. So obviously the Mazik has vested interest in matching the Hezek of the Shar Muad with the Katan, because if he's going to apply muad to the gadol, then he's going to pay a humongous amount of money for being mazik the gadol, and he pays mezik sholem. You know what? Get a match, if you can offer a match between the Muad and the Katan, then okay, let the Muad pay Nezik Shalim, but for what? For a Katan. On the other hand, the Gadol was attacked by the Shor Tam, and therefore there's going to be a very limited amount of damages that the Nizak could collect, according to this argument, this claim of the Mazik, because he only collects Migufo, and he only collects Chatzi Nezik. So in all these cases, Hamotzi Mechavero Olof Hara. And now we get to the sugya. Now once again, I would allow myself to give you an introduction to the sugya. As I said at the outset, Hamotzi Mechavero Olof Hara is the most fundamental principle in all of Dini Mamonos, in all issues that come up in front of the Beis Din that are financial, in the disputants, claims and counterclaims. However, and this may come as news to you, not everybody in the Mishnah, in the Tanoim, agrees that Avotzim Chaver Levaraya. Who disagrees?
Sumchus.
Okay, good old Sumchus. Now, Sumchus wants to cut the damages down, you know, what do you call damage control? Because at the end of the day, we really don't know who's telling the truth. Now again, Sumchus agrees. Let's clear the path here for Sumchus. Clear the pavement. Sumchus agrees, I can't come over to you and say, John, you owe me $1 million. Well, that claim probably wouldn't get me anywhere anyway. No? Okay. So, can I claim you owe me $100,000? Is that a reasonable claim?
Yeah. Well,
you owe me $100,000?
You wouldn't get it.
So John says to Berzon, you know, I like you, you're a good guy, maybe you say a good shiur once in a while, but you're full of hot air. I don't know you a don. So since there's a counterclaim, and a claim and counterclaim, let's Sumchus say cholkim. Well, that's ridiculous. I can't come over and claim, you know, all the money's in the world for everybody, or everybody's going to claim from everybody, and it's good for a socialist state, maybe, or a communist state, but the halach doesn't work with that. So, you know, all the B'nai Kivniks who claimed that Judaism, and I was one of them, that Judaism is a proponent of socialism, that's not exactly true, with all due respect. There is something called Shemitah. Shemitah is socialism, but that's only once in seven years, you know. Good. So what is his principle, what is his psak? And for this we have to introduce the famous concept, which in the beginning of Bava Metzia is called Drora de Mamono. I've had a blackboard, I write it out, but Drora is Dalid Resh Resh Aleph de Mamono. Mem Mem Vav Nun Aleph. What's Drora de Mamono? Drorim de Mamona means that, you know, in every dispute we have to ask, what is the root of the suffix? You know, why are the judges racking their brains to try to adjudicate here, to try to, you know, resolve this conflict? And there are two categories. One category is called Drorim de Mamona. Drorim de Mamona means, you know what, based in... Even before the claims and the counterclaims are in the dark, there's a suffix. Like, let's say, for example, the classical case of Drora de Mamona would be, we have a wall between two neighbors. We don't know who owns that wall. And if the wall falls down, we have to wonder who owns the stones of the wall. You know, the stones of the wall are worth a lot of money. That's called Drora de Mamona. Well, for example, if we see a shor running after another shor, and then we see the second shor, the nidda, dead, it's already a drora de mamona, meaning even before the claims and counterclaims come to the attention of Beis Din, Beis Din already is in doubt. There's a certain darkness or a certain ambiguity about the case itself. So the suffix in that sense is very objective. Objective means below Tanel Sehem, even without that Tainus, this is suffix. However, there are other cases where there's no Drora de Mamona here. Beis Din has no reason to suspect that the shirt you're wearing belongs to him. And what could create a suffix is a Taina. Somebody comes forward, a plaintiff comes forward with a lawsuit, and he says, well, he owes me money. We had no clue. Beis Din, the judges had no reason to suspect that he owes you money. Sumchus is going to try to cut the losses and split with Chalukah in the case of Suffolk if the Suffolk is objective. Because if the Suffolk is not objective, as we said before, anyone could come along and start claiming you owe me $1 million. And what? Chalukim? That's anarchy. But in a case with the Zedrorah de Mamona, that means by chance you have the money in your possession, but if not for that fact, Beis Din would have been wondering whether that money belongs to you. There's already objective evidence to the Suffolk. Okay, the stones happen to fall in your chutz. They could have, you know, it depends which way the wind was blowing. Had the wind been blowing towards the west, it would have fallen in his chutz. So, you know, possession, the fact that you picked up the stones and you locked them up in your chutz, that doesn't prove a thing. So in general, to come along and claim, you know, out of the clear blue sky that you owe me money, you have a reason to throw me out and say, you know, who are you? I don't know you. I never borrowed it on it. That muhzakus, the fact that you are in possession, gives you a certain emunus, a certain credibility. But if there's an objective suffix and it's my word against you, but Bezin is really in the dark, then who's telling the truth and who's lying? Muhzakus doesn't mean a thing. Yes, yesterday you owned this money, it was locked up in your bank account, very secure. But today I see that your shor was running after his shor, and his shor is dead. So what is the fact that the money is in your possession prove a thing? Does that give you credibility? Sure, you're coming and saying, well, no, it wasn't your shor that caused the damage. His shor banged into a stone. Yeah, you know, it could be, but I don't know. He's saying that it was your shor that damaged him, so like, you know, Shlomo HaMelech is here. And then the Shlomo HaMelech of our sugya is Sumchus. And that's what the Gemara says over here. Omar Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba. Now, there's a Girsa issue here, but let's read it Zos HaMeres. You have Zos HaMeres in your text?
Yes.
Okay, so we'll read it with Zos HaMeres. It's bracketed, which always indicates a question, but Zos HaMeres, meaning, if you want to analyze that Mishnah logically, Chalukim Olav Chaverov Al Sumchus. The underlying premise in our Mishnah, from soup to nuts, from A to Z, is that there's a principle called Maman, called Hamotzi Mechavel Varaya, and that premise, which is formulated here by the Mishnah, is a direct argument against Sumchus, the Omar, because Sumchus says, Maman Amuto B'Safek Chalkim. If we don't know who owns the money, we split it. We do the Shlomo HaMelech split the baby, right? That's the best you can do here under these circumstances. Now, if you notice Tosus here, Dibra Maskel Zos, he points out that we shouldn't assume that Sumchus always says that every Suffolk is enough to split. That's only a Suffolk where below Tani Yoseyam Yesh Suffolk. Before the counterclaims, there was already an objective Suffolk. And here too, in our sugya, we have shnei shvarim. You have two, let's say, in that case in the Mishnah, you have two oxen that gored two oxen, and we don't know which ox gored which ox. May elav ole hasafik. The suffik comes by itself. It's self generated. It's spontaneously generated. That's called dror de mamona. Here's where we don't even need their titus. Forget about. Let's shut them up for the meantime. I don't need the claim of the plaintiff, the claim of the defendant. Right away I have a suffix. Oh, in such a suffix, you have to sort it out in such a way that you do damage control, and that's called yachloku. That is the principle of sumchus. And here, we refer to the, Tosus refers to the sugya of Hamotzi Mechavel Vraya of sumchus, and that's in Bava Metzia Daf Kuf. In fact, probably we should have started with that sugya. And that's the case of Machlif Parah v'Chamor. You gave me a Parah. I gave you a Chamor. And lo and behold, the Parah gives birth to a little calf, a little baby. Now, you, the seller, claims, well, this calf was already born before the Mechira. Let's say the Mechira was out in yonder, you know, and we don't know exactly. And therefore, since the calf was already born, I sold you the mother cow, but I didn't sell you the calf. And you, from your perspective, the little calf says, no, I bought the cow with the calf. Because at that time, time that the kinyan was clinched, the animal was, the parah was still pregnant. As I said, both the parah and the calf. And that's why Sumcha says Yachloku. And why does Sumcha say Yachloku? Because, again, below technically say something, the objective facts and figures of the case, right, the circumstance of the case generate a suffix. We don't know. You know, the cow gave birth, so who owns it? The seller, the buyer? I mean, when was the calf born? I mean, go rack your brains and figure it out. We have no testimony. But if a person comes to his friend and he says, Talazu, the talis that you're wearing, is mine, Shali, is then me over Sumpa? So Sumpa say, Cholkim in such a case? Obviously not. So that's the address for our discussion is Tosus Dibra Maskil Zos Omeris. Amalei Rav Abba Bar Mamol Rav Chiya Bar Abba. Wait, hold everything, Rav Chiya. You want to say that Sumchus would argue with our mission? I'm not sure about it. Why? Amar Sumchus. Now, this you have to read as a question mark. If you don't read this as a question mark, you're in deep trouble. Amar Sumchus. When Sumchus made his statement that Moman Abuto B'Safek Cholkin, question mark. Is it afilu bari ubari? Is it even if both claimants, both litigants, have a definite claim with all certainty, right? There are two categories of claims in halacha. One is called bari, the other is called shema, shin mem aleph. Bari means, I know, I was there at the time and I saw it with my own two eyes. Shema means perhaps. In our Mishnah, presumably, again, we're going to analyze this, we're addressing a case of Bari Ubari. And now you're telling me that Sumchus would argue even in the case of Bari Ubari? Meaning, the owner of the Shara Mazik is claiming, I don't owe you damages, or I owe you less damages than you're claiming in all the various scenarios. I know that to be a case. I know that my animal didn't damage you. I know that it was the shartam that damaged you. I only pay you chatzin as a migufo, etc. Did Sumchus go as far as to say that if a muchzak, someone who's holding on to money, and somebody's suing him for that money, that muchzak, who is relying on his muchzakis to support his claim of bari, that I know that I don't owe you a dime, you want to prove that you have to take money out of my possession and sue me for damages, you have to prove that. I have a tiny bari, I'm not going to pay you, I'm not going to write a check. Is even in this case, Sumchus would say Yachloku? Because the flip side is that Sumchus only said it, Yachloku, in a case of Shema. In other words, the owner, the possessor, or the Muchzak, who's the defendant, doesn't really know the facts on the ground. He doesn't know whether he has to pay or he doesn't have to pay. In such a case, Sumchus makes sense. But does Sumchus even go a step further and he says that even if the muchzak, the defendant, is a bari, and he's claiming, I know that I don't owe you a dime, we can still, lock up his, what do they call it in English, when they put a closure on your bank account, what's that called?
Freeze.
A freeze, we're going to freeze his bank account because there's a claim against him. What do you mean? He's muksok, he has money in the bank, there's no proof against him, he has a tainus bari, he knows for sure he's not chayim. Amar leser, Rav Chiya responded, in fact, this is correct. Amar sunchus, afilu bari ubari. Even if both claimants, both litigants, are absolutely sure and certain about their claims, that means both the Tovea and the Nifba, the plaintiff and the defendant, say, I know. Nevertheless, Sumchus says, Yachlok. Why? Because of the svar that we said before, called Drora de Mamona.
What is that?
Drora means a schlepperai. Drora means to a grasp, a grasp. A Drora de Mamona means both of them have a hold or a claim on this moment, even before they come into Besdin. And that's when Sumchus says Yachloku, but even says Rav Chiya, how far did Sumchus go with his principle Yachloku? Even in a case of Bari Ubari. Now, How did Rabbi Abba know that our Mishnah was a case of Bari? Umimai demaslisim, Bari Bari he. Right, what's the premise that underlies Rabbi Abba's claim that our Mishnah is Bari Bari? The Katani, because if you read the Mishnah meticulously, the Mishnah puts words into the mouth of the Mazik, and it says, Ze Omer Sharcha Hizik, Ze Omer Lo, Lo. And again, the Gemara doesn't follow it through, but we'll add the words, Loki Ela Besela Loka. Loki Ela is the mashmos of those words, is a Tainas Bari. Now, I'm just going to give a little bit of an introduction to the next sugi, because I see that, you know, we're going to have to stop very shortly for Mincha, right? And that is that Rav Papa has a problem. Why does Rav Papa have a problem? Because of something that I call the integrity of the Mishnah, or the consistency, the unity of themes in the Mishnah. Meaning, if you've already proven from the low-key Ella that the Reisha is a case of Tainas Bari, then we should anticipate that the Seifa should likewise be a case of Tainas Bari. What I'm going to try to prove to you, says Rav Papa, is that that's not necessarily so. That it could very well be that I have an indication that the case of the Seifa is a case of a Tainas Shema. And that's going to fluke us all up, because it can't be that we're talking about a Bari in the Reisha and a Shema in the Seifa. That's going to be problematic. Now, one more word of introduction. I'll open the door. One more word of introduction. There's a gigantic sugya called Tano Bechitin Vahodalo B'Sa'or. Have you heard of it? I claim that you took from me a volume, a bundle of wheat. You deny it. You say, you got from me, I delivered to you, a bundle of barley, of chit, of seor. So there's a famous principle which was formulated by Rabba called Tano Bechitin. Tano Bechitin V'Hodol of the Sa'orim. He admitted the Osa'orim is pot. He doesn't have to even pay the Sa'orim. That's a pretty revolutionary idea. And what it means is that when I claim chitin, implicit in my claim is a hodah, is a mechila on any other claim. Again, reasonably, not within for the whole life, it doesn't mean that tomorrow I can't. But in this particular transaction, I claim that there was a transaction and you owe me chitin. I lent you chitin or whatever. That itself is an implicit hodah that I have no claim to anything but chitin, and therefore I was mochel on a claim for sa'or. And therefore you're part of even from sa'or. Now, watch this. In the Sefer of the Mishnah, I claim that it was the Shar Hamur that damaged me. You counter and say, no, you were damaged by my Shar Ta. That's exactly parallel to Tano Bechitin Vahodalo B'Siorim. And assuming we're dealing with the case of Bari Ubari, then in this case, the Mishnah should have paskin that I don't even have to pay you for the half damages of a Shar Ta. And the Mishnah doesn't say that. The Mishnah says, I'm also the Kabbalah, right, you want to prove it was the Mu'ad and collect full damages, you have to induce proof and evidence. But certainly, you have to pay me the Torah short time. And that's going to be the problem, how to reconcile this with the sheet of Rava, Tana Mechitin, Vahodol of Siorin, is Potomik. Okay, man?
We'll stop here.